Talking Tennis with Linda Cirque.
So hi and welcome to the Talking Tennis podcast with me, Linda Cirque. Now this podcast is powered by the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club in Reading, England, but is open to absolutely everyone as I sit down and have a chat with Amazon Prime tennis commentator Lee Goodall. Hi Lee.
Hi Linda, how are you?
Yes, very good, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. It's an interesting week that we're connecting in because after a couple of two or three months of inactivity with the tour being in the off season and then tennis sort of heading to the other side of the world down in Australia, I'm involved in the Rotterdam event this week, which is great as sort of tennis is heading back to Europe. So it feels like after, you know, maybe a couple of months of the off season and then obviously all the uncertainty about whether the Australian Open and the Australian summer of tournaments were going to take place, it feels like professional tennis is just starting to gather some momentum, which is great for all tennis fans.
Absolutely. So Lee, can you describe where you are at the moment? Because you're not on Rotterdam, yeah. Are you?
No, things have changed a lot as you would imagine with the TV production side of professional tennis over the last well almost exactly a year ago now actually. This time last year I was pretty much to the day I was in Dubai at the men's ATP event, working on the TV production there. And obviously coronavirus was sort of starting to work its way into the news. And, you know, none of us had any idea of how it's going to affect any aspect of our lives, let alone professional tennis. Now we are commentating from the IMG facility, IMG Productions, which is a huge sort of factory of TV sport production. They cover all sorts of things. Probably most notably, the Premier League production is based there. It's in Stockley Park, which probably football fans will be familiar with that name now because it's where all the VAR technology is. So whenever there's a contentious decision in the Premier League matches, that's where the officials are sitting in Stockley Park. That's where the VAR decisions are made. But it's a huge facility, and that's where the tennis is produced from now. So for the duration of an event, I'm based in a hotel just next to the M4, which is slightly less glamorous than the old days, but I'll take it right now.
Bit of peace and quiet, lovely.
Yeah.
Now, exactly. we're going to find out all about the world of tennis commentating from you in just a little bit, but let's just rewind back to when you first started playing tennis and growing up in Reading. So at what age did you first start playing tennis?
Need to rewind a bit further than that. We sort of moved around a fair bit as kids. We're from Yorkshire originally, our family. I have an older brother who played professionally and is now a commentator as well. But we first were introduced to the game actually in Zambia. My dad got a job in Zambia, in Lusaka, the capital, when we were fairly young. I was 3 years old. Jason's 5 years older. And we'd never really played tennis, to be honest, but we headed over there into Central Africa before the days of Googling places where you can get an idea of where you're heading. I mean, I have such respect for my parents, really sort of taking a fairly young family from York, which is where we're from in Yorkshire, out to Africa in the late 70s. You know, they really had to have a real sense of adventure, and it turned into sort of two or three years, a really great two or three years for our family. And that's where we started playing tennis. School finished at lunchtime each day. And so in the afternoon, you had an amazing climate, obviously, for, you know, most of the year it was blue skies and sunshine. And the expats, the expat community headed to the local sports club. So either you played tennis or you swam or you played hockey or football or any one of a number of sports that were on offer. And we happened to try tennis and it started there, really. And you know, it's interesting. In listening to some of, you know, I listened to a lot of podcasts with interviews of professional tennis players. I was listening to one with Heather Watson a couple of weeks ago, who moved to Florida at a young age. She's from Guernsey, moved to Florida, and she was talking about how important good weather is. And I think it's something that isn't talked about a lot, actually, because we tend to focus on coaching and facilities, which are obviously important elements as well. But you know, on a really basic level, you know, if the sun's shining and the weather's nice and you enjoy playing sport, then I think an environment like that is really important as a kid. And we were just having fun, you know, on fairly ropey African courts with old tennis balls. And, you know, I had a wooden racket that was made in China that was literally sawn off at the handle.
Wow.
And that's how it started, you know, but that was great fun for us. And we played like that for 2 or 3 years and then came back to England, lived back in Yorkshire for a while, and then we moved down to Berkshire because of my dad's work again. He worked in Henley. And then we started sort of, my brother was then 16, so he was part of the national program. And so that back in the day was based at Bisham Abbey and Marlow, or probably the Queen's Club as well. So we needed to be down south. And that I sort of fed into, having played county tennis in Yorkshire, I sort of fed into the South Region system and Berkshire County training, and sort of bounced around a few clubs in Reading and spent a fair amount of time at Caversham, and have good memories from there. They're a bit hazy, but they are good memories.
Oh, I'm sure it's not changed that much from when you were there. But what kind of memories do you have of Caversham Lawn?
I'll tell you one of the strongest, and it's probably not particularly tennis related, but the sort of the regular attendance. I lived in Lower Early, so kind of the other side of Reading. So I wasn't one of those members who were sort of popping in and out of the club every other day. You know, my good friend and still to this day we're in touch on a daily basis, maybe, is Richard Holden. I played doubles with Rich from probably age 10, 11. We played county doubles, regional. We played nationals together. We actually ended up winning the national under 18 title at Queen's before I went off to the States to college. And actually Rich spent some time in the American college system as well. So I went over there to hit with Rich and hang out with him. And his family had a house just in the next road to the club, as I remember it. So, you know, 2 minute walk. So it was junior nights on Friday. And I think maybe I got this wrong, but I seem to remember that the sort of junior night tuck shop operated out of the back of his dad's car. And I have memories of eating a lot of scampi fries on a Friday afternoon.
Brilliant.
And playing a bit of tennis, but generally just having a nice time. And it was a nice environment, as you know, a friendly club.
Yes.
Good standard of tennis, good coaching, but just a nice place to go. And then one of the other strong memories was watching Live Aid the day that happened. Goodness knows when that was. Was it mid-80s, late-80s?
Yes, mid-80s. Was it 1985, I think? Or 1986?
Yeah, and I remember spending the whole day sort of switching from Caversham Tennis Club. We'd play a bit of tennis, have a drink, have a snack, and then we'd go back to Richard's house and watch a bit of Live Aid, and then we'd get a bit bored with that, and then back to the tennis club. And that was how you spent your time back there before the internet and Twitter and Instagram and all those.
Oh,
other
the
things
good old days,
young
wasn't
people
it?
These days. Exactly.
Yes.
Life was simple. Music and tennis.
That's all you need, really. And then, what made you decide that you'd like a career in the tennis world? I mean, not so much on court, but you know, behind a mic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like many careers, probably right time, right place. As I mentioned, I went over to the States for a little bit. I played a year of college tennis, which it was a fantastic experience, and I could talk for a long time about, you know, I really believe in the benefits of that system, and we see more and more professional tennis players come out of the American college system. More on the men's side, there aren't too many female players that come out of the college system, although Jen Brady, who just made the Australian Open final, she was at UCLA. So that was a really good experience. And then I came back after a year and coached for a while. I coached at Westside Tennis Club, which is in Wimbledon Village, which was a great place to coach for a few years, being so close to, obviously, you know, the All England Club, but also in an area where tennis was a, you know, big part of the community. So they had a fantastic junior program there and a really good men's team as well, real great men, depth in the sort of tennis playing side of things. So I was able to keep my standard up and play some good competitive tennis. And then I actually decided to go back to college, and I did a 2 year journalism course. Didn't do anything sport related originally. Actually, my first job was for the Middle East Economic Digest, which
my
is
goodness.
a finance and business magazine that was owned and still is owned by EMAP, which dealt with sort of Middle East politics and oil and gas and petrochemicals and that side of business.
Couldn't be more different from tennis then.
No,
really.
I know, but I tell you what, it was a really and you will appreciate this, some of the you know, the highly respected trade mags. It was a really good place to learn the fundamentals of journalism. in terms of, you know, being accurate and quick and fact checking and just being around really, really, it was a really interesting team of very intelligent people. And it just it was that first foot into real journalism, you know, which is obviously very different to, you know, working on kind of college newspapers and things like that. So that gave me the foot into journalism. And then I quickly realized that, you know, I still loved the sport and wanted to be involved in tennis. So got involved with Ace Magazine, as it was known back then. That turned into Tennis Head Magazine, which was, I think, run by the Lawn Tennis Association for a while before they ditched their publishing department. And then really it was right time, right place in terms of digital TV taking off. So, you know, all of a sudden and streaming and the beauty about tennis, as we all know, is there are tournaments every week in all four corners of the world. So there are a lot of matches that need commentary. And I think, you know, the other very fortunate element is that I'm based in the UK. So a lot of the commentary comes out of the UK, you know, given there's quite a lot of English language commentary available around the world, you know. So it was right place, right time, and there were opportunities, and I gave it a go. And I think because I had a fairly solid editorial background and I had a good enough knowledge of playing. I never played professionally, but I was playing to a fairly good standard, you know, men's county tennis, played for Berkshire. We got up to Division One. So that's a decent standard, and college tennis is a good standard. And having had a brother who played professionally and coached professionally, then, you know, you fit in sort of two roles as a commentator. Either you're, as we call them in the UK, lead, or the colour. The colour is normally a former professional player who can watch a rally and tell you exactly what's happening and why that's happening. And then the lead, which is more the role I do, is, you know, the colour about the players and telling a bit more of the story about the tournament and the backgrounds and trying to get the best out of that person sitting next to you. So trying to put yourself in the position of the viewer. What expertise do I want to try and get from the guy or girl who's sitting next to me? So
I was actually going to ask whether there was a sort of commentator's training program that you go on, or whether you're auditioned to see whether you've got, you know, the voice for a commentator, which you obviously have. But is that something you've acquired along the way, or is there something you've always naturally had?
Yeah, I think it's funny because I just got in touch with this guy recently. Actually, there was a chap I used to work with at Mead Magazine that I just mentioned, and he always said I had a good voice for TV, and I kind of laughed it off. And here I am,
yes,
20 years later. In the business. But no, I think voice is important, you know, and learning how to use your voice, obviously, at the right moment. But no, there's no sort of training as such. I mean, maybe there is now. There may well be a course that I'm not aware of. But in terms of, you know, how you develop, it's just very much learning on the job. I think I listen to a lot, especially in the early days. I still do now, to be honest. You know, I did a match on Monday night, and especially with the challenges of how we're working now, I think it's a different, I'm very aware, it's a different kind of challenge for a commentator to bring certain sports to life. And I think tennis comes into that category of finding the balance of, because we have no fans and very little audio in terms of, especially these indoor tournaments, I mean, they are deathly quiet in between points. And just trying to find that balance between talking too much and not talking enough, and having the right sort of reaction to a great rally. You don't want to be over the top, but you're sending the message to the viewer that they need to watch this last point, or they need to watch the replay. Maybe, you know, they could be in the kitchen putting the kettle on. So you've got to try and sound excited about what you've just seen. But no, I mean, I think the most important thing is just listening to a lot. You know, even when you finish, go back and have a listen and see how it sounds, and asking colleagues as well. You know, I'm lucky enough to work with a lot of good people, and we discuss it all the time, because 99.9% of us want to do the best possible job we can. It's a fortunate position that we find ourselves in.
And in terms of what else makes a good commentator, because you do make it sound so easy, you know, all these facts at your fingertips, but I'm sure you do a lot of research beforehand, lots of stat finds and things like that. So how many hours do you spend on average before a match just looking up details about the players and their statistical background?
Yeah, I think I mean, a lot of it's the beauty of working regularly, and I'm lucky enough to, you know, probably do a couple, two or three events a month, probably on average. And I tend to focus on ATP because I do a lot of work for the World Feed, although at the majors, obviously, I do watch some women's tennis and work on women's tennis as well. But the beauty of working regularly is you're watching matches on a regular basis. And, you know, by and large, you're watching the same kind of players. You know, occasionally there'll be a player who pops up that maybe has come through from the Challenger Tour that you haven't really seen before, and you've got to do a bit of digging. But that's the beauty. And I think that helps you tell the story of players, because then you're familiar with their background, how they started in the game, particularly the coaching scene, which, you know, I think for keen tennis viewers is interesting, you know, how players are developing their games and who they might be working with to be able to do that. So you've got a good idea of their history in that respect. There's still a lot of research. I think the thing I've noticed in the last probably year or so is there's less, and I don't know whether this is an access thing, in terms of it's harder for magazines and newspapers to get decent time with, you know, the very top players and sit down with them and do in-depth interviews. But it feels like the best way I can now research a player and just get a feel of what they're about. And, you know, it's podcasts these days. That's the best source of research, I find, you know, because normally, if you do find a podcast with a player, it's probably a good 45 minutes or hour chat. So, you know, the interview can go down different routes. And there are a fair few tennis podcasts around now. There's a couple of really good ones. There's an official ATP tennis radio podcast. So we talk to a lot of the top coaches on there, who often give, I think, the best, most interesting content, because they know what they're trying to achieve, often better than the player themselves does, to be honest.
But I'm sure the coaches don't want to give too much away because of rival players listening in, getting some tips and so forth.
No, that's true. But they, you know, you do come across some fascinating sort of tennis brains in terms of the coaches. And we don't really see them very much as well. There's never any time in terms of the TV coverage to talk to these guys. I think with podcast and radio, it just gives us a chance to drill down a little deeper. So yeah, podcasts, and you know, when you're driving around a lot, as we all are these days, easy to listen to them, and normally you can find three or four, and that's good prep. And then as well as those, you know, the basics, and it is one of the challenges of these days, though. I've talked about, you know, how the coverage is different in terms of the viewing experience back at home without the fans and without much atmosphere, let's be honest. You know, when you're watching sport now, natural atmosphere. The other, I think, challenge for us as commentators now, we had the luxury of traveling to tournaments and often staying in the same hotels as players and coaches, and that's when you can, you know, really gather some nice color, not only about the events and the area and but you know, things that interest the hardcore tennis fans, like how courts are playing, the surface, how the surface might change over the week, the speed of the courts, the balls they're using that week. You can go talk to the guys who are stringing the rackets. You can talk to the physios. You can talk to the tour staff in the office about any information you might need about rankings or the ranking systems. And you can bump into the coaches. You know, often, you know, you end up sitting on the same table at breakfast as one of the coaches, and you get to know them and have a chat with them. And you can go and watch practice sessions. You can pop into press conferences. So there, I think probably people wouldn't appreciate how much you can gather when you're at a tournament, just going about your daily business, compared to sitting in a studio, you know, just off the M4. Which it's a big difference, and I find that's the biggest challenge now. You know, trying to bring different layers to the commentary that you would naturally pick up just by being in that environment. But hopefully that'll change once things get back to normal.
Yeah, I guess you can't put a price on those sort of casual bits of information that you gather from, as you say, sitting at a breakfast table or meeting someone on the reception desk at the hotel. You know, just getting those little nuggets of information that people absolutely love. So I imagine it's quite a challenge, as you say, commentating during lockdown and also not being in the atmosphere of the tournament as well. I mean, as you say, sitting in a lovely swanky studio is great, but it just doesn't beat being in the midst of the energy of a tournament, you know, and being in a crowd-filled stadium, watching the match actually there at the location.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day as well, not so much now, but I remember in Rotterdam, actually, I think I first went over there maybe sort of 2009, 2010, maybe. It's a really good venue, massive venue in the middle of Rotterdam. Tennis is a big deal over there. The tournament director, Richard Krajicek, who of course won Wimbledon, was a good player himself, so he's done mm-hmm. a good job of raising the profile. It's always a strong field there. But no, back in the day, we were literally sat behind a wooden table, almost in the crowd in Rotterdam. So you really are, you know, sort of surrounded by fans. I mean, the funny story is from Paris, the Paris event in Bercy at the end of the year, there's a big Paris indoors tournament, which is a Masters 1000 event. And before they redeveloped the stadium there, they literally, I never did this, but I've heard from my brother, you are literally sitting in the crowd at a table. But there's obviously more than one match court in operation at any one time. And on the world feed, that for whatever reason, we might not be commentating on the match on the court we're sitting on, if that makes sense. So there'll be a match going on centre court, but because there's more significance or a, you know, an interesting match, or it might be in a third set tiebreak, we might jump over to court one, but we're still sitting in the same place. So you're commentating off a screen on a match in a different hall, but you're sitting in the crowd of a different match, if that makes sense, and you're getting pumped up and you're making a lot of noise. And in Paris, we started getting abuse off the crowd because
I was going to say, you're going to get heckled.
Yeah, exactly. They don't know what we're doing. So no, back in the day, sometimes you really were sat right in the middle of the fans. But no, that's the difference, you know. And for me as a sports fan, it's always about atmosphere. I'm a massive football fan, and I just love the buzz of the crowd and that's that special atmosphere at live sports events. And probably my best memories of commentating are at venues, you know, not necessarily where it was the most incredible tennis or most brilliant match, but where you've sat in a full stadium with an incredible atmosphere in an iconic city.
And so looking back over your career, what's been your favourite tennis match to commentate on?
The O2 has always been good. I mean, that's been a special event, and I've been lucky enough to work that a few times. There have been a couple of matches that stood out. I mean, last year was good, but we didn't have the fans. So again, it was a different experience. But what was really special actually about last year, they put our commentary box just behind the baseline. So normally we're fairly high up in a stadium, and you've got sort of a bird's eye view of the court, but there we're right on the baseline, so we were literally, I mean, 20 feet behind the baseline watching the very best players in the world in an empty
stadium. There was a strong window you were sat behind.
Yeah, we did.
You get whacked by a ball.
You say that. We got a few Zverev serves into the glass, but it was strong perspex, so it makes you jump, and then you're okay. But I mean, there were a few moments where I was, you know, you sort of look bigger picture and you take a step back and think, goodness me, this is such a privileged position to be in. Tennis fans would pay thousands
absolutely
to be sat courtside watching the top eight guys in the world with nobody else in the stadium.
Oh, incredible.
And a similar situation at the US Open last year with no fans. I watched the final between Zverev and Dominic Thiem. I wasn't working that day, so just got a cold drink and a coffee and sat courtside, and they're probably
Oh my goodness. 100
people in there.
I'm so jealous right now. Unbelievable.
Yeah, so, you know, those will always be special memories. And to be part of the first Grand Slam after the pandemic, you know, will always be, I think, an historic moment in the sport. I think in terms of atmospheres, I mean, I've been lucky enough to go all over the place. There's so many favourite tournaments. I think probably one of the best atmospheres is that I've experienced. It was in Rome, the Masters 1000. Clay court event, which is just before the French Open, obviously a big deal for the Italians. Italian tennis is, you know, very, very, very strong at the moment, and has always been. So tennis is a popular sport. Beautiful time of the year. It's a fantastic venue. It's part of the old Olympic Park. So you've got the football stadium, which is where Roma and Lazio play, sort of within 500 yards of the center court, and it's a real sort of amphitheater of a tennis stadium, steep sides, 10,000 seater. And I don't know whether you're too familiar with Fabio Fognini, but has been the leading Italian player for the last probably 5 years or so. And Fabio is one of those guys who plays with his heart on his sleeve. He can have some stinkers, but when he's in the mood, he's fantastic to watch. He's good on clay. The Italians love him. And he played a match against Dominic Thiem there. I was lucky enough to do that match, and the place was absolutely rocking. I mean, it was like I'd never been in a tennis stadium that felt like a football stadium, but it was that sort of, you know, that sort of level of Italian passion.
I was going to say the Mediterranean passion.
Yeah,
had a lot to do with that. I'm imagining
a beautiful sunny day and a great clay court match and fantastic tennis and the fans were up for it and Fabio was up for it, and you know, I think that's when sport really comes to life, when you've got a packed stadium, everyone's having a great time, and it's a great advert for the sport. That was good fun.
Now, at the time of recording, it's Wednesday the 3rd of March, and you will be commentating on a huge match tonight. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, Murray continues his, I suppose you'd still call it a comeback. I mean, it feels like he's been coming back for a long time now.
Yeah, that's true.
He's had so many sort of injury setbacks the last, you know, you've got to actually go back to 2017. It's amazing how few matches Andy's played. In the last, you know, 4 years, the injury really started when he was world number one, incredibly. You know, he's been trying to manage it. And obviously, he's had surgery since then and a ton of rehab. And this is his latest attempt to just try and put a few tournaments together. You know, I think that's been one of the biggest challenges for Andy. Physically, his body hasn't allowed him to play on a regular basis. And obviously, the most recent headlines were surrounding him contracting COVID. That was around Christmas, New Year time. So that meant he couldn't travel to Australia and play the Australian Open. So he played on the Challenger Tour in Biella in northern Italy a couple of weeks ago. And then he played in Montpellier last week and Rotterdam this week, took the wild card into Rotterdam and had a good win over Robin Haase. Wasn't pretty at times, but... He got the win, which is his first tour level win since the US Open last year, and now plays a top 10 player tonight. So he's playing Andrei Rublev, one of the Russian guys who've been playing so well the last couple of years, really, Rublev. So different kind of test for Andy. So it's going to be interesting. You know, I think a lot of Murray fans and fans of British tennis will be watching tonight. So it's going to be fascinating to see whether he can live with a guy who's, you know, starting to cement his place in the top 10.
In terms of, again, your commentating background, as you mentioned before, you already know a lot anyway, lots of facts in your brain, with all the experience you've got, and of course, commentating on his previous match. But do you do any kind of other preparation ahead of commentating on the match?
I was just looking at some of his numbers actually before we spoke this morning. You know, you forget what someone like him's been through. So I think it's... For someone like Murray, you have to reflect on what he's achieved, you know, and I think always in this country, and I think Tim Henman really suffered from this, is we're a bit harsh on our sports stars sometimes. You know, Henman had a fantastic career and was regarded as a failure by a lot of people. I think it was 6 Grand Slam semifinals Tim made. He was top 5 in the world for a long time. And same with Andy. You know, I think recently, obviously, because of the era he's played in alongside Federer and Djokovic and Nadal, you sort of forget some of his achievements. So I think, you know, I think it's important because some of those were a while ago now to, you know, remind people that he's won 3 majors. You know, he was world number one for 41 weeks. He was the year-end number one in that incredible autumn of 2016. Back-to-back Olympic gold medals. He helped win the Davis Cup for Great Britain. All the matches he's won against, you know, some the players who will probably go down as the best players of all time in terms of Federer, Nadal and Djokovic. You know, he was regularly beating those guys in some of the biggest finals in the world. And then, you know, had all these physical problems. And then, you know, you list those. He missed most of 2017, surgery 2018, resurfacing surgery 2019. Then he had a pelvic injury and then he's had COVID, you know. So you're just trying to...
Heartbreaking.
Yeah, I think you're just trying to put into perspective what he's been through to get back to playing on the tour, which is incredible. You know, I think it's easy to forget that the guy's got a metal hip, you know, and he's still competing with the very best in the world. And, you know, it's easy to forget that. And then, you know, obviously, you know, you have to remember that it isn't just a British audience that you're working for this evening. So you've got to tell the Rublev story as well. And I've just found, so, you know, this is how I spend some of my time on a day like this. I've just found a Russian documentary about Andrei Rublev on YouTube, which is 46 minutes long. So after I finish talking to you, Linda, I will be enjoying that documentary which thankfully has English subtitles.
I was going to say, it's not in Russian, is it?
No, but he's an interesting guy, is Rublev, and I've interviewed him a couple of times. Very humble, good perspective on where he is in the game. Even though he's top 10 in the world, he always talks about his weaknesses rather than what he does well. And he suffered from a little bit of depression in the past when he was injured. So he's got an interesting story, you know, and I think, like I touched on at the start of the chat, I'm not the tennis expert, if you like. So I've got Barry Cowan, who's a former pro, next to me this evening as the color commentator. He's analyzing more of what's going on between the lines, and I'm trying to tell the stories of the two guys who are playing. But I really warm to Rublev. So it's always nice, you know, if you can find these interesting snippets on the internet. There might be a podcast or two out there, and just try and be able to be in a position to put their careers into perspective and you know, educate viewers about their background a little bit and where they want to go.
And so finally, Lee, what tips do you have for anyone who'd like to get into the world of commentating? What first steps should they take?
I think, I think the advantage, and I assume we're sort of talking probably teenagers, aren't we? I mean, thinking back to my youth, you're probably someone who loves playing sport and watching sport. And with the growth and emergence of social media, I think, and podcasts, and, you know, I think it probably would be a good idea to be involved in some sort of media production if you can. You know, I'm thinking if I was the head of ATP Media, and I've got letters and emails coming from maybe 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, or people coming out of university who've done media courses and they're interested in this line of work, you probably want to see some sort of evidence of being proactive in terms of producing media content, and or just do it yourself, you know, either podcast yourself, have a go at making podcasts, or Instagram feeds. You know, there are so many, I think the thing that you realize when you start working in TV, there are so many different roles in the background. I mean, it is mind-boggling when back in the days when we were on site and you would arrive on site, you go into the production office and you get your accreditation, and then you see all your old mates that you see around the world, and you pop into the director's cabin, and then there's the probably three or four edit suites who are producing all the news feeds and highlights and hot shots that you see on the internet and Twitter and Instagram, and then you've got the guys who do the graphics. I mean, the list goes on, the audio. There's so many different roles in that TV production world. But I think that's probably the first thing, you know, be aware that there are different routes in.
Well, Lee Goodall, thank you so much for joining us here on this Talking Tennis podcast, powered by the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club, one of your former tennis clubs. Thank you so much.
Very welcome. Very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Talking Tennis with Linda Sirk.
So, I hope you enjoyed the first episode of Talking Tennis with Linda. And as you know, Lee was speaking before commentating on the second round match between Andy Murray and Andrei Rublev in the Rotterdam Open. So, if you want to know what the score was, well, Andy Murray was knocked out 7-5, 6-2. This podcast is powered by the Caversham Lawn Tennis Club, which is a brilliant club based in Reading in England. And if you want to find out a bit more about us, then head to our website, caversham.ltc.co.uk. And the music has been very kindly provided by Reading DJ producer Ooeez, that's OOEZ, whose link is in the show notes. And also, the show title voiceover was recorded by D. Ray Kickett, and his link is also in the show notes. So thank you very much to both guys there. You can join me in 2 weeks' time when I chat to BBC Radio 2 sports journalist Mike Williams. Now, he commentated on the epic Wimbledon men's singles final in 2019, and he's got some brilliant behind-the-scenes insights into the championships there, including a story about Nick Kyrgios. So until then, bye! We'll be right back.